readers, and welcome back to Ravenclaw Readers with me, Claire.
And me, Ella.
And Paul.
This week, we're turning our attention to Chapter 11, Quidditch, reading it in conjunction with the tale of Jason and the Golden Fleece, as told in the Argonautica. The Argonautica is an epic Greek poem written by Apollonius of Rhodes sometime in the 3rd century BC. This epic tells of the dangerous voyage undertaken by the mythological hero Jason, accompanied by his crew, the Argonauts. So Ella, would you please remind us what happened in the Quidditch chapter before I give the summary of Jason and the Golden Fleece?
Okay, so it's November and the Quidditch season is about to begin, with Harry able to make his debut in the very first match, which is Gryffindor versus Slytherin. Around all of this excitement, Harry is becoming increasingly suspicious of Professor Snape after eavesdropping on a private meeting between Snape and Filch, where Snape, who is sporting a gruesome leg injury, makes reference to the three-headed dog guarding the trapdoor. Before he can pursue the matter any further, however, there is a Quidditch match to compete in. Everything's going relatively smoothly until Harry's broom suddenly takes on a life of its own and tries to throw him off. Hermione instantly guesses some dark magic is at work and scans the crowd for the perpetrator, where she notices Snape muttering under his breath with his eyes fixed on Harry. Making her way towards him, she knocks Quirrell off his stand and sets fire to Snape's robes, causing a huge disturbance which distracts the Jinxer. Back in control of his broom, Harry wins the match for Gryffindor by somehow almost swallowing the snitch. While celebrating with Hagrid later that day, Hagrid accidentally lets slip even more information about the mysterious thing Fluffy, we now know is the name of the three-headed dog, and also reveals a new name, Nicholas Flamel.
Oh yes, so many hints being dropped in this chapter. Yes, I love your political equivocation of Hermione stops the Jinxer, not to be too direct with what exactly happened there. I'm going to read a little bit from the Argonautica that we're looking at today, but before I read the extract, I'll just give a little intro into what exactly is going on. King Pelias of Iolcus sent Jason on a quest to retrieve the coveted Golden Fleece from the coastal region of Colchis. This is no ordinary mission, however, as the king plans for Jason to meet his death on this journey. Fearing a prophecy that foretells Pelias's demise at the hand of a man with one sandal, whom Pelias thinks is Jason. We're focusing on book 4 of Apollonius's telling today, which opens with the Colchian priestess Medea in a state of distress. Her concern stems from the fact that she has agreed to help Jason retrieve the Golden Fleece, a move which would be considered treacherous by the king of Colchis, King Aetes, were he to discover what she has done. So Jason and Medea set out to capture the fleece as follows. So this is from the Argonautica. And they too by the pathway came to the sacred grove, seeking the huge oak tree on which was hung the fleece, like to a cloud that blushes red with the fiery beams of the rising sun. But right in front, the serpent with his keen sleepless eyes saw them coming, and stretched out his long neck and hissed in awful wise, and all round the long barks of the river echoed the boundless grove. Those heard it who dwelt in the Colchian land, very far from Titanian Aea, near the outfall of Lycus, the river which parts from loud-roaring Araxes and blends his sacred stream with Phasius, and they twain flow on together in one and pour their waters into the Caucasian Sea. And through fear young mothers awoke, and round their newborn babes who were sleeping in their arms, threw their hands in agony, for the small limbs started at the hiss. And as when above a pile of smouldering wood, countless eddies of smoke roll up mingled with soot, and one ever springs up quickly after another, rising aloft from beneath in wavering reeds, so at that time did that monster roll his countless coils covered with hardy dry scales. And as he writhed, the maiden came from before his eyes, with sweet voice calling to her aid sleep, highest of gods, to charm the monster, and she cried to the queen of the underworld, the night wanderer, to be propitious to her enterprise, And Aeson's son, who is Jason, by the way, followed in fear, but the serpent, already charmed by her song, was relaxing in the long ridges of his giant spine and lengthening out his myriad coils like a dark wave, dumb and noiseless, rolling over a sluggish sea. But still he raised aloft his grisly head, eager to enclose them both in his murderous jaws. But she, with a newly cut spray of juniper, dipping and drawing untempered charms from her mystic brew, sprinkled his eyes while she chanted her song, and all around the potent scent of charm cast sleep. And on the very spot he let his jaw sink down, and far behind through the woods with its many trees were those countless coils stretched out. Hereupon Jason snatched the golden fleece from the oak at the maiden bidding, and she, standing firm, smeared with the charm the monster's head till Jason himself bade her turn back towards their ship, and she left the grove of Ares dusky with shade. And as the maiden catches on her finely wrought robe the gleam of the moon at the full, as it rises above her high-roofed chamber, and her heart rejoices as she beholds the fair ray, so at that time did Jason uplift the mighty fleece in his hands, and from the shimmering of the flocks of wool, there settled on his fair cheeks and brow a red flush like a flame, and great as is the hide of a yearling ox or stag, which huntsmen call a brocket, so great in extent was the fleece all golden above. Heavy it was, thickly clustered with flocks, and as he moved along, even beneath his feet, the sheen rose up from the earth. As he strode on now with the fleece covering his left shoulder from the height of his neck to his feet, and now again he gathered it up in his hands, for he feared exceedingly lest some god or man should meet him and deprive him thereof. Why the secondary text was chosen? Well, Jason is one of the most well-known heroes of Greek mythology. Jason's heroism is signified by his daring and nerve in the face of great danger as he quests to collect the golden fleece. But he is also thought of sometimes as a more human or realistic hero, in comparison to, say, Heracles, for example. The fleece is celebrated and well-renowned, and as such, it is a symbol of greatness. I wanted to think about Jason's search for the fleece in parallel with Harry's search for the snitch during his first Quidditch match. Similar to Jason, Harry is on a quest to prove himself and to show his worth. How does Harry's heroic mission stack up against Jason's? And what are the models of heroism on display here? And how are they similar or distinct from one another?
I suppose when I first read the two texts, I thought they were rather dissimilar. Jason is sent on a doomed mission to receive a golden fleece. He's supposed to fail. And the other is the chapter is about a young wizard is sent on a doomed mission to receive the golden snitch. And then I realized, hold on, that's very similar. It seems like Harry is sort of doomed by Snape. Secretly using the dark magic, which he doesn't overcome, but Hermione sort of comes to his aid, just as Medea comes to Jason's aid.
Yeah, I definitely saw those Hermione Medea parallels for sure.
But I think similarly, like a larger framing of Harry searching, it's framed in the mystery of what's in the basement, and Jason always knows what he's looking for. He's looking for the golden fleece, and he knows where it is. But as with the snitch, Harry has to find it, and he also doesn't know what's under the trapdoor. Harry doesn't know that goal. It's not defined yet, but we sort of see it taking shape in Snape, in that it becomes him trying to stop something evil occurring. Can we see that, the Quidditch match is like a miniature version of the overarching story of what, the basement, and because the players are the same, but the game is different.
The game is the same, but the rules are different. Reminds me of what we were talking about last week regarding the stated rules of the Hogwarts rules versus the unspoken rules of from the chivalric code or personal interaction. So again, we have that idea of bending the rules and toying with them a little bit. One of the things that they say is that Hermione, since becoming friends with Ron and Harry, has been a lot less strict in her bending of the rules. And it says that she's become a lot friendlier for it, or a lot nicer for it. Like, they find out that much easier to get on with. And obviously we learned of the distinct rules of Quidditch in the previous chapter, but this time we see them in play, and Harry's trying to find out about the rules from Quidditch through the ages, and Ron, of course, telling Dean that there's no such thing as a red card in Quidditch and you can't send people off and all that kind of thing. And one of the things as well that I thought of is this idea of Paul mentioning Snape, and Snape, as we know, turns out not necessarily to be the evil figure that we think he is in this chapter. But there is a bit where Snape comes across Harry and Ron and Hermione, and he takes the Quidditch book away from Harry and says, you're not allowed to take the book outside of the school building, and confiscates the book from him. And Harry is very incensed and says, oh, he just made that rule up, which again speak to that bending of rules, but perhaps on Snape's part. Like, I don't know, did he make that rule up? Maybe he did. I honestly think Snape could have just been really cranky and decided, you know what, you can't do this and I'm mad at you, so whatever, 10 points of Gryffindor and I'm gonna take this book.
They do reward breaking the rules.
They do. Hogwarts does, though.
Yeah, you can break the rules as long as it works out.
Do you think that's true of Hogwarts, Ella?
It rewards breaking the rules?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like in Harry's case, it certainly does. But we don't see very many of the other students breaking the rules. So how can we make a representative judgment on that?
But so many of the students that we know of who went to Hogwarts all broke the rules all the time.
And Fred and George, Dumbledore's obviously very aware of the fact that they're breaking the rules all the time.
Tom Riddle, we know, broke the rules all the
time. Do rules make sense in a world where magic is rule breaking? Like, your magic, you can't have a rational rule system when you're also a wizard and can make a blue flame in a jar and then set it on some, you know.
In Quidditch, for example, then there are clear rules, and what Hagrid says when Harry's broom starts going crazy out of control, everyone starts getting worried about him, and Hagrid says that it's only dark magic could interfere with a broom. There definitely are certain rules in place. Like, there is magic to counter magic, if you know what I mean. So J.K. Rowling has said this herself, and I really like this quote, that the wizarding world can have solutions to problems that we don't have those solutions because of magic, but also at the same time, they create problems that we don't have as well.
I was, we've discussed previously about magic and feelings, and that, like, the flying on a broom, or, you know, it's like an expression of a feeling, or Ron, only when he's in danger and he needs to cast the spell can he do it. And so there's this, like, direct link between, it's like, I think we've said in a previous one that brooms are like horses. They can respond to your feelings. They respond well to a confident driver, and they're to a nervous driver, they're like, knock you off and things. So it's and what was interesting was only dark magic can override that and take over
whatever protective magic is on the
so brain. It is, what, you know, is protective magic, or is it that dark magic breaks that taboo of changing inner feelings? And do you see what I mean? That if you were to, a simplification would be Harry's use of the broom is like an expression of his inner feelings and blah blah blah, and to override his feelings is it to be dark magic. So I don't know if there are rules against, like, are there such things as love potions where someone can make you fall in love? Is it a permanent thing? Is it dark magic? Is it
weird? It's very strange with love potions, because we will come across them. They're kind of marketed as a joke, right? Like, they have them in the joke shop.
I think they are, if they're like temporary, and it's like, you know,
I'll say that.
But there are also the sinister overtones of making someone fall in love with you, which we can get to later in terms of Tom Riddle's heritage.
Well, in the Argonauts, we have Jason and Medea. Mm-hmm. And Medea is made fall in love with Jason by the gods. And later on, Jason reneges on his promise to marry Medea. That's correct.
Yeah, so...
under the premise that it wasn't true love, but yeah.
Zeus's wife, Hera, and Athena are both champions of Jason. Think that it would be a good idea for Medea to fall in love with Jason because it would help them on their quest for him to get the Golden Fleece. So the god of love, Eros, who is known more famously maybe as Cupid in with his Roman name,
Greek name was Tinder.
Is persuaded in the usual god-like kind of trickery, playful form of shooting an arrow into Medea, and she instantly is, you know, completely head over heels in love with Jason and wants to help him. You mentioned her breaking
the argument that it's not true love.
Yeah, well, when you talk about them eventually having a pretty disastrous and indeed murderous end, that I don't think happens in the Argonautica. I think it happens, it is part of the story, the Jason and Medea story, but again, they come from lots of different sources. Yeah. I think so there's a famous play with that as a subject matter by Euripides. I think it's Euripides. I haven't read it, but anyway, yeah. So that is part of the story, but I don't think it's part of the Argonautica that Apollonius wrote.
Oh,
you know, it's very confusing, all these retellings, but I think that's kind of what makes it interesting. Your point about it being... So Jason would think that it's not true love. So is the love that he instills in people, even if it is for certain ends, the god's ends, is that not true? Mm. I mean, is it the same as giving someone a love potion in the magical world? I don't know.
I don't know, because one of the big arguments, I think, in Harry Potter...
question is Eros's if you fall in love under the hour of Eros, is that true, or is Eros a manifestation of love, or is it a god interfering in humans? I think that's a very complicated question. I don't think there's a simple answer to that. I think the answer is both, depending.
So Eros's love is bound up with the gods and trickery, and the way that Medea's love comes about is, you know, an instant infatuation with Jason. So perhaps it would be symbolic of like the dangers of infatuation. Ultimately, I mean, to be fair, things kind of work out for them at the end of the Argonautica. It comes to a bloody end for many, but not for Jason and Medea in this particular story. But yeah, it is like that danger of infatuation, and you have to be careful with that, which I think would speak to Harry Potter, because I think, yeah, as you said, Ella, love in Harry Potter takes many guises, but it is something that is true, and there are... You know, there are distinctions made between different types of love. And I think infatuation always comes with a bit of a warning label. I mean, maybe even like, despite his redemption, Snape, we can kind of see that in his character a bit. So yeah, someone who is infatuated isn't necessarily a bad person or irredeemable, but it just means that it colors their love in a way that other like types of love, like friendship or whatever, might not.
I suppose... you should make a distinction. The love in myth is not a love between two individuals, but between two archetypes. And in comparing myth and, say, Harry Potter, we must remember that Harry Potter is an individual. He is not. He may draw from the archetypal hero, like Jason or Odysseus, as we discussed, but he is still a. I was going to say a human being. He is a human being.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting distinction that you make between Jason and Harry, as Harry as a more modern hero, because during the time that Apollonius was writing, I think Jason was in a way, this is one reading, I mean, there are many readings of Jason. Some people love him, some people hate him. But one of the readings is that Jason is the modern hero, and that at the beginning of the story, Heracles, a.k.a. Hercules, is there. And he was initially going to be like the captain of the Argo, the ship, and then they voted for Jason because that's what Heracles suggested. And then Heracles, I think at the end of like book one, gets left behind somewhere. So there is, some people have read that as this distinction between Heracles as the old archetypal hero and Jason as the new modern, in a way more flawed hero. And yet, yeah, even for now, our contemporary readership, we see Jason more as archetypal and Harry more as modern, yeah. He's more of an individual than even Jason was. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting.
Sorry, we went down a bit of a rabbit hole there.
I suppose another distinction between in myth is that accidents don't really exist.
Yeah.
They're subsumed by fate. And you can't necessarily say that the opposite is true in Harry Potter because of the existence of magic. And I do ask myself the question, one, was Harry's catching of the snitch an accident? Or was it supposed to happen? Or did Snape make it happen on purpose or not on purpose?
I'll just give this the warning. All is not as it seems.
Oh, really? You see, I should have paid more attention when you said your very judicial...
It was very like, diplomatic answer.
Stopping
yeah.
the hijinks. Well, I can only go by what I've read.
I will admit, it does not look great for Snape in this chapter.
Okay, so... well, is it an accident or is it...
About Harry catching the snitch.
Yeah.
What do you think, Ella? Because, yeah, I realised that it doesn't really give much of a description of that. It's just like suddenly, oh, well, there you are. He has the snitch now and the match is over.
He has to catch the snitch in order to kind of complete his challenge, if we're looking at it in this sense. But I think it was entirely accidental on Harry's part and the way it was depicted.
It's an interesting question to ask because... You know, magic is as we've seen with, what's that guy in the wand shop?
Ollivander.
Ollivander. There are still, like, mysteries which we can't comprehend with magic. So you never know what's supposed to happen and what's sort of accidental.
Something that I am getting on this reread is, and I was discussing it with my brother, because I went back to Ireland to visit my family recently, and he's been listening to the podcast, and he was saying...
Hi, John.
He was saying that there really is this sense of the old magic, this old, ancient, kind of unknown aspect to it, and I feel like that's going to come back more. Actually, maybe I'll say some of that for the next chapter, because of course we'll get the Mirror of Erised. But it is hinted at a little bit in this chapter with the name drop of Nicholas Flamel, and of course we know that Nicholas Flamel is a famous alchemist in real life, but also in the book.
I was reading recently, speaking of old magic, I was recently reading the preface to the Dewey Reams Bible, which is an early sanctioned Catholic translation of the Bible in the 16th or 17th century. And I think it's the preface written by John Fognier. He's saying that despite there being a translation, so the translation was written in response to the dissemination of Protestant translations, and that despite that, the text might be readily available to you to read, one still should not read it. And that whilst, like, is it Cranmer?
Thomas Cranmer, yeah.
Thomas Cranmer, right. You know, sort of had this idea that anyone can approach the Bible and take of its medicine. The sort of, the Catholic sort of view was more that this is a dangerous and, like, only the chosen few can read this book. And they do so with fear and reverence for the mysteries within, And you can, you know, you can still see that old way of thinking in the character of Ollivander, that, you know, this is, you know, he sort of sums up that idea of that magic is not a plaything, but something deep and can be misused and can change you, not necessarily for the better.
I think we see a bit of that again at the end of the chapter when Hagrid name drops Fluffy. Which Paul could not believe that was the name of the dog.
I think it's a typo.
but I think that in a way does speak to Hagrid's character, in that he sees this ferocious and perhaps dangerous beast and decides to call it Fluffy. And actually, I know this is getting a little bit ahead, but the way that Medea soothes the serpent that's guarding the Golden Fleece with her song reminded me of how, in order to get past Fluffy, they have to play music to send it to sleep. Again, I guess that's just kind of a very traditional mythological callback, and that the beast can be soothed by something. But then it's like what Dumbledore said, in that music is beyond anything that can be taught at Hogwarts. So there is a deep magic to music, and it is something that goes back all the way to Apollonius and before.
I suppose the beast in the Argonautica is the thing he must overcome to get the reward. But you sort of, in Harry Potter, we learn in this chapter that Fluffy is he's put there for his protection, and that what he must actually overcome is beyond that, is darker, and is, as we've sort of said at the start, unidentified.
So talking about that scene reminds me of the Medea Hermione parallels that we alluded to earlier, and obviously we've talked a lot about Harry as a hero and how he is similar or different from many of the ancient heroes or their you know, the archetype, but what do we think of you know, Jason wouldn't be able to get past the serpent, or at least not as easily, to get the fleece if it weren't for Medea. It's through magic and through her charms that he is able to do that. And it is through Hermione's magic, maybe not quite, maybe it's more accidental, but still, Hermione's magic and her ability to perform magic, and she instantly sees Snape and she thinks he's trying to jinx Harry's broom, so she rushes off and saves Harry through her magic. And I was wondering, what do you think of Hermione's actions here? Do you think that she is being heroic in a way that we possibly haven't discussed yet, in terms of, you know, we were talking about maybe two weeks ago with Ella, you mentioned like the male-female distinction of honour. Do we have like different male-female distinctions of heroism here? I don't know.
I would actually agree with that and say that Hermione is being heroic in this. And I don't think it's just me reading this chapter with, you know, the lens of being a 21st century feminist, but I also see Medea as the hero of the Golden Fleece story, because she's really the one who leads it. And Jason, I think at one point it's actually described as kind of cowering in terror at the serpent. And it really is Medea and her magic that helps him to overcome this, and he is the hero because he retrieves the fleece, but he couldn't have done it without her. And I think we see that in the same way in the Harry Potter chapter, where Hermione is the true hero of the chapter. She is the one who disrupts the jinxer, and kind of allows Harry to get back on his broom, and in getting back on his broom he somehow manages to swallow the snitch and win the match for Gryffindor. And then he suddenly becomes the hero because he's won the match. But really, he couldn't have done that unless Hermione had helped him. He would have just fallen off his broom. So I definitely see the women of both chapters being the true heroes of the story.
Yeah, I think Medea is often thought of as the most engaging figure in the Argonautica. And I definitely, from what I've read, I would agree with that. But yes, in your, what you say about Jason, you know, cowering, that's also what a lot of the crew of the Argonautica, sometimes they're brave, but sometimes they're not. And so that would speak to Jason as a more realistic or less archetypal hero for, I mean, the 3rd century BC, you know, that would have been quite distinct. I don't necessarily see it as a Hermione being done an injustice by not being celebrated in the same way that, that Harry is once he catches the snitch, because I think that Hermione isn't seeking to be celebrated in the same way that, you know, the Gryffindor team want to be celebrated. I think that Harry acknowledges how great having Hermione on his side is, and even from the beginning where she helps them with their homework. So I think as long as Hermione is respected and acknowledged in her friend group, I think that's what she
I would agree with that. I don't think she's even trying in her own mind. Yeah, I don't think she sees herself as a hero. Yeah. She just like, you know, my friend's in trouble, I've got to save him. It just so happens that she comes across as heroic to us.
I think in the Argonautica, it's the gods sort of intervening through Medea, so they make her fall in love with Jason. So I mean, if the gods why interfere in this way? Why not just do something else? So I suppose that the fact that they've made Medea fall in love with Jason is important. And I suppose that it's through love that Medea is soothes the savage beast, and Jason is awarded the golden fleece, and then Medea is supposedly awarded kinship through marriage and a new country and stuff. So they're sort of doing it. It's the power of love, which overcomes the beast. But in Harry Potter, it seems to be the friendship and camaraderie, which, as you said, inspires Hermione to do what she did and enables Harry to win the match. So I suppose we can't expect children to understand romantic love, but we can certainly believe that they understand the importance of friendship, especially Gryffindors, my boys and girls.
Well, yeah, it's also the power of camaraderie as well. There's a nice sentence here where Harry's just walking out onto the pitch and he's feeling very apprehensive. It says, out of the corner of his eye, he saw the fluttering banner high above, flashing Potter for president over the crowd. His heart skipped. He felt braver. And I like that, because it shows that, Harry is always like thrust into the spotlight in a way that Hermione isn't. And I think Harry, he's not 100% comfortable in the spotlight, and sometimes he hates being in the spotlight, but I think that he's not completely ill at ease with it. I think he always, maybe it's just because he has to learn, because he's the famous Harry Potter regardless of what he does. I think that he still ends up doing relatively well in these high pressure, everyone looking at you situations, I think much better than I would. But it's nice that, you know, he might be the famous Harry Potter, but he still looks to his friends for that support, and it's that bolsters him on and keeps him going.
So I was thinking, it is the love of Medea and Jason which enables them to enter that sacred space, and there is a demarcation between the sacred and the profane, and in a way, like, sacred spaces are indivisible. So I was, for example, I was in a church in London once, and they had installed a jungle gym in the church, and it wasn't a jungle gym in a sacred space. It was a jungle gym replacing a sacred space that you can't really have that cross-hatching profane and sacred. But in Harry Potter, they seem to do that. They have these sacred places where magic's powerful, you're not supposed to go. And in, surely the whole Hogwarts is that. But they do have ordinary, everyday, boring, profane sort of experiences, like eating sausages with loads of ketchup. Or, you know, these are very normal, comforting, everyday spaces which we would, as readers would feel, would be aware of and comfortable in, but they sort of exist within the sacred space. And I think that's quite an interesting thing. That, you know, even in these myths, even though the mythic space of the river flows through, there's no part of it which is not sacred, whilst Hogwarts seems to be split up that way. And I suppose that's only possible because they are wizards and magic is sort of in their blood.
Mm. It's like magic is inherently sacred.
Yeah.
Yeah, even in like a joke shop.
But they're still human.
Yeah.
It's like they're completely magical but also completely human. Like Jesus.
One might say like Christ, yes, completely divine.
Well, more like Christ, completely divine but also born of man, yeah.
Yeah.
Which the expression of which in paintings is very interesting. That inherent contradiction. How do they represent that contradiction? I suppose they don't really, rather than just separating the sort of everyday occurrences of an 11-year-old boy. Is he 11? 11-year-old boy. And then the magical things. So you have a man dropping a teapot, but that man is a giant with a pink
beaver
umbrella.
Skin boots and
moleskin jacket.
Gloves, yeah. I love the Hagrid descriptors in this chapter.
And it's a strange... The chapter opens with Hagrid defrosting broomsticks.
Mm, I love it, yeah.
Which is like everyone knows the like, you know, waking up your parents defrosting the car on the cold icy morning, but this is a magical, so it's a strange world where everything is magical but also sort of normal.
I think that's why we love Hogwarts though, like as readers, you know, we always, like, that's why people are so enchanted by it, because it is familiar yet also strange and wonderful at the same time. Again, an exploration that we will probably continue throughout the whole series of bravery and what is bravery. So this is after it's after Snape has confiscated the Quidditch book from Harry, Quidditch Through the Ages, which is also available, I think, to actually buy as its own copy.
On our website.
No, but it's before the match, so Harry's getting really apprehensive about the match, and he's like, I just want to have my book back so I can read it. And then it says, why should he be afraid of Snape? Getting up, he told Ron and Hermione he was going to ask Snape if he could have it back. Rather you than me, they said together, but Harry had an idea that Snape wouldn't refuse if there were other teachers listening. And I'm wondering, why does Harry bother to do this? Like, is this brave? In a way, it kind of is, but it's certainly not brave in the same way that they were when they faced the troll, which of course was very stupid but brave at the same time. And it's not brave in Hermione's shooting the blue flames at Snape. Is it just being reckless? I don't know, because I would be terrified of Snape if I was a 11-year-old child at the school. I don't know. Okay, not to be sympathetic with Snape, because he, as I have made it perfectly clear, he is a terrible teacher and should not be anywhere near teaching these young children. But if I were Snape and I was looking at Harry with my biased eyes of this boy's always causing trouble and he's just like his father, I could see plenty of evidence of that would affirm my judgment of him. He is always breaking the rules. How many rules has he broken since he's... And it's only November. It's only November, guys. Look at how many rules he's broken. Like, the troll... You know, he breaks the rules for Quidditch to get on the Quidditch team. There's a troll in the girls' bathroom. Snape walks in. Harry's right there. Then Harry goes back to try and get his book. He walks in. So he walks into the teacher's room, and there is, you know, Snape chatting with Filch about the scar on his leg. You know, in a way, I think I can see why Snape's his own biases against Harry would be just more and more confirmed through all these actions. So is Harry just being reckless? Any thoughts on that?
I think it's Harry's treating Snape as just a regular teacher. I mean, we've all experienced unjust teachers taking your property, and I've gone recklessly knocking on the teacher's door, like, the sense of justice.
No, I can't. Ella, would you have done that at school?
No, definitely not.
The more I read this, the more Paul is like Harry. It's crazy. You were such a Harry. It's insane. I would never have done that ever in a million years.
And then we see here Harry sees a glimpse of, well, a darker side of Snape, maybe, or like in a vulnerable state where he shouldn't have seen him before. So it starts as a sort of everyday, you know, there's nothing magical or unique about it, but it becomes so.
I'm seeing a lot of parallels between this chapter, this instance, and Snape's worst memory, which we will get to when Harry goes into the pensive and sees Snape again in a vulnerable position and Snape loses it. This is exactly what happens in this chapter is, yes, Harry, obviously, as you said, Paul, he sees a darker side to Snape, which is suspicious to us as a reader and also very suspicious to Harry. But as you said, Paul, I think one of the things that Snape maybe doesn't like is not necessarily that he would see, you know, that Harry would see his leg and assume that he was going after another thing on the third floor, because Snape doesn't know that Harry knows what's there. So it's just that Snape doesn't want Harry to see him in this position of vulnerability. I don't know. What do you think about this whole situation, Ella?
I don't know. I'm just like busy, like on my own track now of thinking about how can I parallel Harry's story in this chapter to Jason's story in the Argonautica chapter that we read. And I saw Snape taking away Quidditch through the ages, which Harry had been using as a kind of preparatory study guide to how to be a good Quidditch player and how to win his match. Him taking it away was kind of like the obstacle that Harry has to overcome in order to complete his quest, his match, however you want to call it.
Transformation into the hero.
Just in the same way that Jason has to overcome the serpent and get the fleece.
Yeah.
At the start, I was like, oh, well, he has to overcome that. Actually, the serpent is the dark magic on his broom, and he must overcome that to get the thing.
Oh, yes.
And then I was like, but actually, the dark magic is the Fluffy the dog, which you must overcome to find whatever's in the thing. So there is this.
We see all circles of these. Yeah, exactly. There has to be multiple threats, really. Because if we also think about Jason, they're being pursued by the Colchian army as well, who were trying to get them to stop them getting the fleece, or if I remember correctly, or something like that. Anyway, there's a lot going on. There's threats from multiple fronts.
Because he's been pursued by two different kings and the army and some of the gods. Yeah, you're right. So it isn't just as simple as like the one obstacle that you have to overcome.
That fundamental essence of like the hero overcoming something and to get the reward to go forward is it repeated several times in the in the story.
I feel like I very carefully skirted around the issue of the Jinxer in this chapter so as not to give away any spoilers, but at this point I would have to go full spoiler.
It's okay, I think Paul doesn't...
Am I good to go ahead?
Yeah, because Paul doesn't remember very often.
Okay, well that's fine then. I will make my point, which was about proving your worth. And we've already discussed how we've seen lots of different people both in the Argonautica and in this Harry Potter chapter, proving their worth. We've had Jason and Medea, we've had Harry and Hermione. But I also thought, in a way, we kind of see Snape proving his worth. Because his leg injury was a result of him trying to find a way to prevent Quirrell from getting through the trapdoor. And his supposed jinx, he's actually performing a counter jinx to protect Harry, because it's really Quirrell who is the one who is jinxing him and trying to throw him off his broom. So really, Snape is being a hero too, in that he's trying to help protect the Philosopher's Stone and protect Harry. And of course, like, Harry doesn't know this, and the first time reader wouldn't know this, but kind of with like retrospective perspective, if that makes any sense at all, we see that actually Snape's kind of a hero and really proving himself in this chapter as well.
I've noticed that we've kind of been ending on a quote, or at least I've been quoting stuff recently, and I think that that's something that we could do, maybe start off as a little tradition of picking a quote from either the Harry Potter chapter or the secondary text chapter. I'm tempted to keep doing it from Harry Potter at the moment, but if something from the secondary text like jumps out at you, do that. But I want to pick up what you said about on what you said about Snape. But this is the quote that struck me when I was reading this chapter. So Oliver Wood says to Harry, just before the Quidditch match. He tells him to keep out of the way until he spots the snitch, and don't get involved in anything on the pitch until he sees the snitch, and then just go for it. And he says, "We don't want you attacked before you have to be." And I thought that was quite ominous, really. I mean, probably very sensible words from Wood, given what we know about the dirty tactics of some of the Slytherin players. But, you know, there is the sense of inevitability. It says, before you have to be. So that's a very direct, it's you do have to be attacked. That's part of how this is going to act out. And I think his words end up being more prophetic than he realises. And in a way, possibly, then we can read Snape's heroism. In this chapter, we do see his heroic qualities coming through in his protection of Harry. So he's the one who sees that Harry does have to be attacked and will be attacked, because, as we will know, that Dumbledore kind of warns him all about not just Quirrell, but, you know, Dumbledore can foresee basically what was going to happen to Harry eventually having to stand up against Voldemort, and he knows that Snape has to protect Harry in this. And that's what Snape is doing, and he is trying to... He knows that Harry's inevitably going to be attacked, and he sees this happening, and he steps into that role as much as he detests Harry. And as I said, I can see where his biases are being affirmed, but or being confirmed, but I don't think that he's being fair to Harry. But I do see how his heroism comes into play in that.
I just thought the fact that you brought up Oliver Wood made me think about how... the best sort of heroism is always a team effort.
Yeah.
And there's usually a figurehead. So you get, you know, Jason or you get Harry. But when you really look at it, it was a huge team of people who really sort of helped bring about the end result.
Mm-hmm. Both for the Quidditch team and for the dirty jinxes on happening from the stalls.
Absolutely. And in most great stories, classical and otherwise.
Yeah. How about this for a quote?
Oh, you have a... Paul has a quote too. Okay, maybe. Go for it.
It's from Kassira's Mythology as a Symbolic Form. For mythical thinking, the relation between what a thing is and the place in which it is situated is never purely external and accidental. The space is itself a part of the thing's being, and the space confers very specific inner ties upon the thing. So I suppose in relation to Jason and the Argonautica, the... that the Golden Fleece is beyond this the snake, and the only way to get past the snake is through, with Medea's help, which she wants to help, her motivation is through love, that infers the object with certain qualities, just as perhaps the Philosopher's Stone's existence in the bank, it confers it with this mystery and this danger, and its later placement in the basement of Hogwarts. But I suppose it is no accident that the Golden Fleece is positioned where it is in this sacred space on a tree.
Of course, we'll see that this snitch is actually very important.
Is it?
Oh, I can't believe we haven't mentioned that. But yeah, this snitch in this particular match is really important. It's more important than like any other snitch in the series, because it will return in books.
It would allow us to come full circle in our story.
The other end, out the other end.
Yeah, I never even realised that, but of course that's very significant. So in a way, the snitch is kind of paralleled in this chapter to the Golden Fleece, is that it is this sacred object, but it's not yet sacred, because it's just a sporting object at the moment, but it will be turned into something that is sacred through Dumbledore's magic later on in the seventh book. So again, I love that speaks to what Paul was talking about, the layering of the profane and the sacred in one object. Thanks for listening, everyone. Next week, we'll be discussing the Mirror of Erised in relation to Ovid's Metamorphoses, looking specifically at book 3, and that's the story of Narcissus. We'll talk to you then. Bye.